Hello and welcome to QS Cast. Each week we take a look at the big stories in Magic Finance and give you the story on what's worth buying and selling. If you're subscribed to Quiet Speculation's Insider Service, you're hearing this podcast on Wednesday. If you're not already signed up, you had to wait till Friday to hear this. If you're not familiar with the Insider Service, head on over to quietspeculation.com and you'll find out about all the ways we can help you pay less money to play Magic.
All right, today on QS Cast, we are going to be talking about a couple interesting topics. We have GP Brussels. Kelly is really excited about all the Rally of the Ancestors decks that showed up there. He is confident that there are still a lot of good pickups to be had from there. Another thing we're going to be talking about is the shifting importance of picking up cards when they first come out versus picking them up on rotation and hoping for the modern bump later. Chaz is going to be talking about that, and then we're going to be discussing also why it is that we sometimes miss cards. And I'm talking we not only as the three of us, but the entire Magic community, sometimes just the Magic Finance community, misses out on cards that spike. The Hangerback Walkers, the Jaces, the Den Protectors. We're going to be talking about all that kind of stuff today with useful ways we've figured it out to make sure that we screw up less. And I think that's the best we can hope for. So I hope you'll join us for the whole conversation. First, Kelly, let's talk about Grand Prix Brussels. And why don't you tell me about the dominance of this Rally of the Ancestors deck, what it does, and why we should pay attention to it.
Yeah, I'm really excited about GP Brussels and the Rally of the Ancestors deck that came out of it. This sort of style of deck was pioneered by Christian Calcano's team at the Pro Tour, and it's a Rally of the Ancestors deck using cards like Nantuko Husk to power a sacrifice engine, and you kill them with Zulaport Cutthroat, Nantuko Husks, and then you get value from sacrificing creatures when you have Grimhara Specs and Catacomb Sifter out. You have cards that are good to sacrifice for value, like Elvish Visionary, and you have Sidisi's Faithful, which is an awesome 0/4 blocker for one mana that is a sacrifice engine that lets you sacrifice a creature to bounce one of theirs. So, I mean, it does everything you want to do. Keeps you alive, has an enter the battlefield trigger. And the real key here is it's a collected company Rally the Ancestors deck. All your 28 creatures have converted mana cost 3 or less. There's only 8 non-land cards in the main, non-land non-creature cards in the main. You've got 4 collected company, 4 rally. So you can fire off rally for at most 5 mana, and you bring back Jace, Nantuko Husk, High Respect, and you just combo off and combo off. Coco makes sure you never run out of gas. Visionary gives you more gas. Sidisi's Faithful keeps you in the game. High Respect draws you cards while Catacomb Sifter scries away the ones you don't want, and gives you extra fodder to sacrifice. I was really impressed with watching the blue rally deck at the Pro Tour, but this really seems to have found the right balance of cards. The 8 non-creature non-lands means Coco is always going to be gas, and it's really found the right way to optimize for Grimhara Specs. You know, there's almost no tokens in the deck. It makes great use of Jace, and I think the key was probably finding that 4 Elvish Visionary, 4 Sidisi's Faithful were important, because this deck looks so, so streamlined, and it's such an interesting case for looking at the evolution from pre-Pro Tour Standard, where people were kind of tinkering with Aristocrats, to post-Pro Tour Standard, where people were still tinkering with it, but it was more focused with blue, to coming up with this super streamlined list. Notable by her absence is Liliana, Heretical Healer. The fact that she makes a token is less attractive because of Grimhara Specs, and she's at the top end of your curve when you really need something better at the bottom end. So I'm really excited about that deck, and it's placed, the Scandinavian team just dominated with it. You've got Magnus Lanto in blue rally, Simon Nielsen, same deck, Martin Mueller, same deck, and then, yeah, 3 in the top 8, and then a number elsewhere, but 3 decks that were kind of marginal before cracking the top 8 of the GP, really noteworthy. So I've said enough about that. We can move on. We've got an Atarka red deck in the top 8, which not really seeing any innovation there. It's just, it just seems like it's a different combination of the cards. Interesting in the sideboard, however, is the 3 Chandra Fire of Kaladesh. That's a card that's getting cheaper and cheaper despite Origins fading into history rather quickly, as small run sets tend to. Nothing much else there. The Rattleclaw Abzan deck is interesting. I love that Exert Influence is a one of main, one of in the side. I think that card still has tons of potential, and it's basically all rare now because there's so much BFZ on the market, and there's so few cards in BFZ that are actually worth any money.
Mm-hmm. On the top 8 view is that the one deck we're not looking at here is Dark Jeskai. The $1,000 elephant in the room is not in this. Neither is Abzan. Well, there's one Abzan deck. But The notable point for me is that there's two Esper Dragons decks in the top eight, and that is a deck that fell out of favor because Crackling Doom wrecks that deck. You know, you tap out for Ojutai, or you tap low for it, and your opponent can Crackling Doom it, and if you counter that, if they flip a Jace, they can run that Crackling Doom back again on you. So it's
best
interesting
to deal with Dragonlord Ojutai, and fortunately, it's rotating, Ojutai isn't. And I'm glad you brought this deck up, because I was about to get to it, not for any of the reasons you might think, though. Because two uncommon specs that I am shockingly overweight on compared to my overall portfolio are the Dragon Enabler cards, your Foul Tongue Invocations and your Silengar Scorns. I have over 100 Silengar Scorns because Card Kingdom was selling them for way too cheap for way too long. Foul Tongue Invocation to a similar degree. And just as a reminder, Foul Tongue Invocation is an edict that gains you 4 life. Silengar Scorn is just a straight up 2 mana hard counter, if you control or reveal a dragon. So, all of these cards will survive rotation except Crux of Fate. Considering it's only a 2 of, I wouldn't be too worried. Dig Through Time goes away, but we will surely see at least one more decent card draw spell in the next 2 sets. So I think that, quietly, this Esper Dragon's Shell may end up being something that survives rotation almost completely unhindered. I think that the uncommons are a decent spec because you can still find them cheap if you look carefully. Dragonlord Silengar looks like an awesome pick here.
They average at about $5 a piece, and it's interesting to see that where previously people were running 2 copies of Silengar the Drifting Death, now we have the Dragonlord replacing them, so that means that there's less weenies, there's less spot removal that threatens Silengar, so now we're just running a straight-up theft.
Yep. Silengar also, I'm just having a mental block here. Does Abzan Charm exile 3 or greater or 4 or greater?
3 or greater, so it will hit a Dragonlord
Silengar.
So
he will hit Dragonlord. Okay. But yeah, we have a couple copies of Esper Dragons here. They all look fairly similar, and actually, the winning Esper Dragons list only runs 1 Crux of Fate, and it's running 2 Scatter to the Winds, which is the 3 mana counter spell that you can cast for 6 to make a 3/3 land instead. Lucas's list here has a bunch of interesting one-offs, like Complete Disregard, Ojutai's Command, Murderous Cut, Clash of Wills, and I think you can do that because of Dig Through Time, and to some extent, Ojutai and Jace. Dig the time leaving, you still have Jace to help you find your one-ofs. I believe it was Patrick Chapin that I talked to at the Pro Tour who said that running a ton of one-ofs in the control deck was great because you have the opportunity to see so many cards. It gives you the value of having 2 or 3 copies when only taking up 1 deck slot. So yeah, this deck survives rotation almost entirely intact, and I think that it's a great source to look for valuable underpriced cards, and most crucially, it isn't completely crippled by the loss of fetch lands like, you know, 4 color decks would be.
Unfortunately, there's no red green Eldrazi or mono green Eldrazi or whatever ramp in here, but it still is an interesting evolution of what Standard is. I think if you asked me, say 3 weeks ago, I would have said that Dark Jeskai is the deck to play, and that that you better be prepared to shell out to play it. But it is good to see a couple alternatives, even decks coming back from the past that we had written off. Ojutai's Command is not quite the blowout that it was, bringing back Dragon Master Outcast and things. People are seeing ways to defeat it, to work around it. So
yeah, if Dark Jeskai only plays 2 copies in the top 32, which is shockingly low. Esper Dragons, on the other hand, was absolutely everywhere. So perhaps a dearth of Dark Jeskai led to the dominance of Esper Dragons, because Crackling Doom didn't see hardly any play. I mean, it's good. It's like Dark Jeskai being a $1,000 deck is utterly ridiculous, and it's completely unsustainable. Doug, I was talking to one of our store owner insiders this morning, and he was saying how pretty much since the Pro Tour and the resultant Dark Jeskai price debacle, his standard attendance has dropped by well over 50%. I think he said like his average was like 40 people, which like fills his store, versus I think he said he got 11 last week. I mean, people just don't want to deal with it. And it's not even that Dark Jeskai is a bad deck or anything, or like people can't afford it. Like in principle, they're just like, ugh, I don't even want to deal with it. Like they feel like if they can't afford Dark Jeskai, they just shouldn't play the format at all, which is stupid and wrong because there's plenty of decks that cost less than half of that. But it won't last for too long. All the key cards are rotating out, so we just have to endure for a few more months. And this proves it's hardly the best deck in the format. It's just a deck. And just because Finkel played it in the top 8 doesn't mean you should.
Yeah, it's Standard's definitely that kind of revolving door where any deck, like, can fall in and out of favor right now. And I think, to add on to your point, Kelly, why people are kind of not really interested, it's not only the price. I mean, it's just getting kind of stale, I guess. I guess that's the best word. It's still status quo, like we said last week. And, you know, there's not a lot of innovation to be had. I mean, like, we saw these ramp decks starting to get a little bit more favor, but again, I mean, you're still going to need a ton of fetch lands, Jace, you know, whatever else, and just having to shell out a lot of money to play Standard. And why are you playing a lot of Standard when A, they're going to be rotating, and B, it's just not that exciting. I mean, people just don't seem to be that excited about it.
Yeah, fetch lands are extraordinarily expensive, and 100%, they made sure fetch lands would be crucial to the format as soon as they printed the tangos. You can't not play those. That's the whole point. But in the process, fetch lands are now at the point where they are the most scarce and the most combined with the most in demand. They're not going to reprint them, like, to alleviate 6 months of price pressure. They probably don't even have time to reprint them, nor would they. I mean, I think it would just be very upsetting. Which is unfortunate because at this point we're like, okay, we're going to get one more set in BFC. Khan's block is still going, or Khan's and Fate are still going to dominate the metagame. And then finally all those cards will be gone in April. So we're basically anticipating the release of two new sets before things change. It's the fetch lands, plain and simple. It's the fetch lands and Jace.
Yeah, I think that's Standard in a nutshell.
Well, Chaz, we wanted to talk about also, you know, with Standard being updated so much like it is, you wanted to speak about why the old model of picking up cards on rotation may be obsolete, and why you instead see that there's an ever more important need to get it right when the cards are even in their pre-ordering phase. And I want you to talk to us more about that.
Yeah, so I think this ties into, we were going to talk about a very good forum post that you made, Doug, and it sparked a lot of discussion. And I think this kind of ties into that a little bit, sort of. But I was asked, like, there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of, you know, Standard price fluctuation. A lot of things are kind of quiet. I mean, you have cards like Ugin that are increasing and whatever. But we talked about this off cast, and the time for price spikes, like spike after spike after spike that we've seen in Standard, you know, not that long ago, is kind of over. And I'm inclined to agree. And the way I answered, you know, that question to why is things kind of cooling off? Well, things kind of just cool off after Pro Tour. But I think the bigger question is, you know, why is it quiet? And I think with this new block cadence, maybe it's just Standard right now, but I feel there's going to be a real big importance to evaluating what these cards are going to do, even in the pre-order stage and in the initial phase of when they're released, then later on. I mean, we're not seeing a huge amount of cards spike after release that much anymore. You had Gideon, but, I mean, like you said, I mean, Gideon is so good that it kind of just beat us over the head with it. So we saw that. But, I mean, again, it's getting to a point where all these slam dunk rotation, quote unquote, all that talk of the past is going to be going to the wayside, because rotation is just not going to be what it used to be. Rotation is going to happen a lot quicker. Picking up old set cards at rotation is probably not going to even be the best idea to do anymore, because you blink and it's almost time for them to rotate afterward. I mean, you're going to get, not to say that it's never going to happen again. You probably will see some modest gains on cards here and there, but, you know, you're not going to see, like, those cards instantly spiking after rotation like you did. A really good example was, like, Jace, Architect of Thought.
I think it's less likely, because we're going to see cards in a lot of different contexts, because the sets are going to rotate faster. So a card in BFZ we're going to see in the context of the next set, Shadows of Innistrad without Khan's and Fate, Shadows of Innistrad plus the next one after that. And then we're going to see, when Dragons and Origins rotate out, we're going to see Battle for Zendikar cards in context of four to five new sets that have been printed after BFC. So I think that you have the potential for these spikes, but the key to making actual money in anything less than the, you know, 9 to 18 month window is going to be getting card evaluation right during pre-order season. I think that's the way you, and I hate to say it, but like, you know, you can pre-order Fathom Feeders at 50 cents and feel great that you got it right when they go up to $2, but I'm not trying to dig on the call that we made here. Like, it was still a good choice, but like, it's not seeing play right now. because it's just not the right context. But like, were you right to buy those at 50 cents? Yes, you were, because there still has yet to be an opportunity to buy them significantly cheaper than that. And then obviously with Jace, if you had bought him at any price, you would have made money. But why didn't you? Because you misevaluated it like I did. I just didn't think it looked fine. Like, it looked good, but it didn't look as dominant as we all see it to be now. So,
right, I mean, even Dragon Lord Ojutai was sitting around $5.99 like during pre-order and became a dominant force in Standard. I mean, even Gideon, the ally of Zendikar, was pre-ordering around, what, $25, ended up going to $35-$40. So there were still some modest gains. It was obviously a bigger risk, and that comes into play when people are talking about pre-order prices. Obviously, you know, you're going to have a little bit of a hesitation buying the $25 card and hoping that it goes to $35 card. But when it's the only good card in the set, you know, obviously you're going to have to buy it. I mean, obviously, Fathom Feeder being the 50 cent pickup going to $2 is still great. But again, yeah, it's not seeing play. You know, the evaluation just needs to be in the pre-order phase, initial phase, rather than later on, because we're going to see very quickly now with this increased cadence that cards are either going to be good or they're not. And even cards like Mantis Rider, and it's like the best example that I keep going back to, is like the best card that's $1. And you can't tell me that there's a better card out there that's going to be better than Mantis Rider and eclipse $1. I mean, it's going to get harder. And I think that's why the shift to getting it right, like right as these cards are spoiled and revealed and initially playtested, is going to be so paramount going forward.
So, Chaz, I want to build on that, too. You talked about how, you know, the rotations are going to happen more quickly. And I think in my mind about a graph of a Magic card's price over time. And on the left, we have the pre-order price. And let's say that's $5. And then let's say the card gets really popular in a Standard era, Standard past, and it goes up to $20. And then we know it's in Standard for 2 years. So maybe 3 months, 2 months, 1 month before rotation, it tapers down sharply as people sell their copies. Dealers price them down, and finally after rotation, maybe it settles back down to that $5 level. Restoration Angel may be a good card to think about in that regard. And it seems to me that what you're saying is that when we get that downward slope, when we're nearing rotation, that since you're cutting 6 months off of that, the hill that we form in the middle of that high price with the card sees play has steeper slopes, because you don't have as much time of it for it to be up at that high price. And maybe that whole summit of that profit peak goes down, because maybe people are saying, well, you know, I'm 5 months from rotation, I'm getting this card. I don't need it. I will skip out on it completely. So maybe there's less of a demand to even get it.
Right. And you also have to, you know, take into account, we even talked about, you know, people losing interest, not playing Standard. Kelly talked to a store owner. I mean, it's going to get to a point where the rotations are happening. People could just skip a whole Standard season and then come back. Yeah, I like I said, I just think it's going to be shifting towards getting the cards right early on. That's where the bulk of the profit's going to be made, rather than, you know, trying to get it in the middle of its cycle when, you know, the next rotation's already kind of looming and then it finally goes out the door.
And I think of some cards like Snapcaster Mage was one of those cards where people were hoping for it to drop. I was one of them. Snapcaster was probably $25 in Standard, and I was hoping, like, oh, you know, I'm going to get these for $5 once they rotate. And that and Liliana were the two cards I remember, which means Innistrad is probably 4 years old now, and we're old people, is that those were two cards that never dropped on rotation. And more with cards still being playable in Modern, like Jace is a card that will have some playability in Modern. I don't think you're ever going to get Jace Vryn's Prodigy for $5. That card's going to come down significantly, but it's going to be like how Snapcaster was $18 the day after it rotated out of Standard, and that was just as low as it ever got.
Yeah, I agree with you. Especially, yeah, if these cards see Modern play, the drop-off is not going to be that great. I mean, even with the fetch lands, they're probably going to drop significantly. There are a great number of amount of them out there, akin to the shock lands. They are going to drop, but they're not going to, you know, totally drop off an edge of a cliff. Like, they're still used in Modern. A card like Jace is still good in Modern, but it's just any other good card in Modern. It's not going to be a $70 card. It'll probably be a $25, $30 card, akin to, like, Snapcaster Mage, like you said. But, yeah, I mean, these price graphs are going to be a little wonky once we are fully into the new block cadence. So, obviously, we'll have more to talk about then, but I just feel from like the initial analysis of this blockade, it's, I feel that's where the shift is going to be. People are going to have to be, you know, on the money, I mean, no pun intended, literally, about these cards, more so when they're released rather than later on in their timeline.
So coming from that, we also want to wrap up the cast talking about why sometimes we miss cards that end up being standard defining things. And, you know, I hate to miss these things. I hope we get them as soon as we can. But why cards, specifically in my mind, Hangerback Walker and Den Protector, were cards that if somebody told you they were knew about that card early, they're probably lying to you. Those were cards that people really needed to sit down and play with to figure out their power level. Kelly, what are the dangers of being an armchair person who doesn't actually load up the cards in Cockatrice or proxy them up and put them in their deck to try them during spoiler season?
The danger is that until you've played with cards in context, you don't understand them. You're going to do what's called hyperbolic discounting, and you're going to underestimate the likelihood that a card is going to underperform. So let's take Undergrowth Champion. You've got the worst case scenario where he comes down and gets, you know, removed by, you know, a lightning bolt or something like that. You're going to take the best case scenario where you play fetch land after fetch land and he becomes an unkillable monster. And you're going to give too much weight to the bad, and you're going to give too much weight to the good when evaluating it. What you're not going to do successfully is understand the probable case scenario as to what's most likely to happen when you are playing for top eight in an important tournament. Not what is the best case scenario, not what is the worst that could happen, but what is the most likely. So that's what people can't really ascertain, because there's no way to get that without logging the matches or running some sort of hyper complex simulation that I don't believe anybody's developed yet. So it's just like when, if you, I don't know, so if you were like, if you watch like boxing or mixed martial arts, and you think that because you have seen other people fight that you can fight, like, or like watching a kung fu movie, and it's like, you're like, I could probably handle getting punched in the face. Like, no, you probably can't. Like, the first time someone hits you in the face, you're gonna freak out. Unless you've been logging time in, you know, in the circle or whatever they call it, and you know what it's like, and you've contextualized it, and you've worked with it. Like, you don't know what a card's going to do until you are relying on it to keep you alive and punish your opponent while they are trying to kill you from 20 to win the game, to win the match, to make top 8, or something like that. Now, you don't have to have actual stakes on the line, but even, like, when I test on the NPGO beta, for example, I am playing to win the game. My opponent is playing to win the game. And until I see what happens when random magic events conducted by real magic players using decks they believe to be good and winning decks, until those occur in large enough numbers for me to form a real mental model, whatever heuristics or logic I am using to try to understand and come to grips with what the card does is going to be inherently flawed because of our cognitive biases and just because we don't have any experience with it. I think the real issue is when you look at a card whose name that escapes me, but essentially when you untap with it, it Dark Confidant. And it was a 2/1 for one black and one, and it was also
The one from Theros. It was like a zombie or something.
I don't know what it was. It was one of those Theros-inspired cards.
That card is called Pain Seer.
There we go.
That's the one. The one you're thinking of from Gatecrash is like a 4/4 flyer, mythic rare for in blue-black. Right. But still, it's the same concept. So it's one of those situations where the surface-level similarity is extraordinarily deceiving, and it's very much a distraction from what the card actually does. I mean, the conditions for triggering those effects, one of them is take your turn, and the other is attack and untap with a creature. The only similarity is their power, their toughness, their mana cost, and the resultant effect after the trigger. But what's really important is the difference in those triggers. And I think that's what people are blind to. They feel the need to compare Jace to Merfolk Looter, which is a completely different thing. They forget to take into account that, like, fetch lands mean you can flip Jace earlier than these things. Like, they just make these associative leaps. Like, they go, oh, well, Jace's ability has to be activated 5 times to put cards in the graveyard. Like, they're just not evaluating the full picture, and you can't evaluate the full picture until you're forced to confront aspect of it in a gameplay situation where you're playing to win against an opponent with an unknown hand and no particular desire to let you off easy. So that's why I said in a recent article, like, you just don't understand a card until you sleep it up and try and play it against someone who's trying to beat you, plain and simple.
Yeah, and to go like to your actual post, which was really good. Again, I say it was well done and
sparked
a lot of conversation. Yeah, and you mentioned like Den Protector as an actual example, and I thought that was good because for a while, kind of Deathmiss Raptor was kind of going off under the radar, and I definitely wrote that card off. I will be the first to admit that. I wrote the card off. I was more interested in Dragon Lord Ojutai. You know, obviously, you know, I was right and wrong at the same time, just fine. But you said Den Protector, and like all this hype, I think it was a top level podcast saying like Deathmiss Raptor is actually a pretty good card. And then like no one realized like, hey, Den Protector is also green, also flips, can get back Deathmiss Raptor. And other cards totally got eclipsed by just how good Deathmiss Raptor was, and no one like took the extra step to say, "Wow, you know, you could play both of them in the same deck, and that would be a really good engine." I don't think we get really surprised. I think what we get surprised at is how much the card actually increases. Like you said, Kelly, a lot of people got Jace wrong, and it's okay to get like cards wrong. It is okay. I mean, it's not okay when you know you're spending money on it, trying to make money. You want to minimize those kind of decisions and bad decisions as much as you can. But no one expected that card to be a $70 card. I think like that's kind of where the surprise comes into. And like you said, Doug, in your post, and it's just people just kind of miss they don't take the extra step. Like, you know, why is Dragon Lord Ojutai, why is Deathmiss Raptor good? Well, what are also cards that are good around them? There's the Den Protector. You know, that's also good with Deathmiss Raptor. So I don't know. It goes back to my point where people are going to have to be better about evaluating cards right off, like right from the start, than trying to find these gems as we go along.
Den Protector is a phenomenal example, and I bring it up alongside Hangerback Walker. Those are two cards that, to me, I really needed to play with to figure out how good they were. So, which is interesting because they both have analogs. Eternal Witness is the obvious one for Den Protector, and then Chronomaton, which is an old Magic core set card that was one mana to play, it Hangerback Walkers. It has that same tap ability. It doesn't spawn Thopters, but that card was busted in Limited because it could just come down and keep growing. And the idea of running that thing out for another mana, so making a 2-mana 1/1, and then knocking it up with the idea that you're also going to be able to cash it in for Thopters, I didn't think that would be standard playable, although you can see the ability. I just thought it would cost too much. Like, at 4 mana, your opponent is summoning a Siege Rhino and killing you. But it turned out to be a very good card, and I think that if I had just put that in a deck, you know, and this is not like, okay, you have to find out what to cut. I mean, like, put 4 copies in an already existing 60-card deck and just run 64 cards in your playtest games, or put one in your opening hand in your existing 60-card deck.
I was about to say,
and
I really
see how
like
it works.
Like, feeding your opening hand with one card to ensure you know what it feels like.
Yeah, or say, I'm going to draw this card as my card on curve when I want it. So let's say you're testing the hypothetical new Siege Rhino or something at 4 mana, or Gideon, and you say, would I want to draw this card on turn 4 every game? You know, so you can have it on curve, but it's not going to cost you anything before that. I think that's a better way to evaluate. I'm just struggling to find and create ways to better evaluate cards in the future and think about what turn they're going to be impacting the game. Like, for me, Eternal Witness, it was a 3-drop when it was in standard. But you often didn't want to run it out on turn 3 because you might be getting back a land or an Oxidize or something like that. And it didn't really do a whole lot run out on curve. Whereas a Den Protector, you get to sit on that ability a little bit. And I had misevaluated the power of that. So that, for example, you cast your hero's Downfall and then you buy it back. Or you can blank your opponent's removal because they know now they either have to kill the Mark Den Protector because everybody knows what it is, or they have to kill your big threat twice because you're just going to buy it back. If I had played maybe 10 games with that card, seeding it in my opening hand, I would have seen that it was more powerful. But I mean, I'm just as bad as everybody else is about quickly dismissing a card without trying it out.
Yeah, I think it revolves around cognitive biases that all humans have, so we're all going to be bad at it. And the way you overcome
danger,
a cognitive
you know,
bias is you identify it and you create a system that lets you make decisions that circumvent that bias. And,
yeah,
like
at least you become aware of it. I'll say the danger is that it's not missing a card like Jace. Like, that's not the dangerous thing to do. The dangerous thing is thinking that you have to get the next Jace before it spikes.
Exactly.
So you end up spending, exactly. Yeah, you end up spending a lot of money on a new card that doesn't work out. It doesn't pan out. Like, if you spend zero and you theoretically lose out on some profit, you haven't lost any money. But if you spend $80 and then buy list those cards shamefully 2 months later for $10 a piece, like, you've lost $40. That's,
yeah.
Like, that sucks having to lose all that money. That's the real danger. Like,
if you're going to go that route, like, you just have to look at what's inherently powerful. What doesn't need any other card to be good? And, like, that's where, like, you want to try and find the Gideon. It might not always be there, but try to look, like, if you're going to do a sweep of the set and try to invest into a card. You know, Dragonlord Ojutai, and I use that as an example, was a pretty damn powerful card on its own. It was a 5-mana, 5/4, flying, it had evasion, it did something when it hit opponents. It was a pretty powerful card. I mean, those are the cards that you want to look for. Missing out on the Deathmiss Raptor Den Protector is a little more forgivable. Obviously, if you spent zero, you didn't lose anything, because you just didn't know if the synergy, like, the synergy's there, but there's also the extra step in. You know, maybe the synergy isn't that good, even if you test it. But if you look at the inherently good cards, I mean, even going back to Mantis Rider, another example I use all the time, like, almost in every single podcast, that card was, like, it was pretty underpriced, and then suddenly it was, like, $7 a card because it was that good. It was just inherently a good card.
Before we wrap up, guys, Chaz, you had wanted to say something about modern cards coming up. We have Grand Prix Pittsburgh is coming up this weekend, I believe. Should be a huge North American Grand Prix. We're going to see a real tour de force of modern decks, the good ones, and also will still influence modern prices. Chaz, you have some picks for us about cards people should keep in mind, and then maybe some things that they should stay away from for the time being. So I'll let you talk about that.
For insiders, myself and Adam Yurchik posted two modern articles, kind of back-to-back, which is great. It's good. A lot of our cards kind of line up in both articles, which is great. We talked about them on each cast, which is also great. So just a couple of cards. Scapeshift, we've mentioned that before, is still looking pretty attractive, under 30% spread. A buy list right now of 15, a retail of 20, which is pretty good, I mean, all things considered. So the renewed interest in that archetype with all the things that we outlined in both articles, getting access to Bring to Light, even going as far as saying even some of the fetch lands from Khan's block that were, you know, new to modern has definitely helped out the deck, including the battle lands kind of, it's a slow deck, so obviously gaining life off of the mana base is obviously a great place for the deck to be. We've seen a new combo deck in the Hulk Footsteps combo. I've seen Protean Hulk show up a few times on daily stock lists, and there's not a lot of them out there. So you can look at non-foils and foils to kind of stock up on inventory if you need to. If not, you know, by all means, you can glaze over that one for more attractive stuff like the Scapeshift, like the Dark Confidant, Noble Hierarch, just those quintessential modern staples. So just going over a few more cards. I've seen Keranos suddenly creeping up on the buy list side. I don't know really what that's all about. I think it's a pretty good sideboard card, but showing a lot of renewed interest, maybe even some casual appeal, you know, being removed from Theros block a little more. People like to kind of have these cards for both modern and kitchen table stuff. So look for that. I gave a bunch of stuff in my article as well as Adam. Again, we have Scapeshift, Spellskite, Noble Hierarch. Those are kind of the cards where you want to be. Even Fulminator Mage and Abrupt Decay. Abrupt Decay especially, there was kind of this inflation when every single, like, finance article was saying buy Abrupt Decay some time ago. It was obviously a good advice there. Started this kind of inflation, but didn't really hit the numbers everyone was expecting. I expect without any kind of foreseeable reprint in sight, that'll start creeping up again. And even look at cards like Thoughtseize. It's a top 10 card in Modern. It already got a reprint. I don't really know where they can kind of fit that in again. I wrote about it months ago, stating it kind of has this snapcaster effect, like you said, Kelly, where it didn't really drop that much from rotation. So You know, if you're going to definitely if you're going to play with them, pick them up sooner rather than later. So, yeah, there's a lot to digest from those articles.
Well, we will be having a lot to talk about after the Grand Prix, and we're going to be seeing if things like Scapeshift and Thoughtseize have a good showing. I especially like Thoughtseize as one of those cards that will eventually climb back up to about $30. They're about $16 to $18 right now, depending on where you look. So they're not cheap to get, but I think that's one of those other blue chip cards that, due to its recent experience in Standard, we will not be seeing a Standard legal reprint of Thoughtseize ever, which is my guess on that.
Yeah, that's a good guess.
Yeah.
It's pretty damn strong.
Well, we talked this week about Grand Prix Brussels and the Rally of the Ancestors deck. We talked about some cards that Kelly likes in that he thinks are worth picking up. We chatted about how it's more important these days to get cards at the beginning of their release versus try and make profits picking them up cheaply when they rotate. And we also spoke about common traps that people can get into when they are evaluating new cards and how to avoid those traps, try and pick up better profits, and avoid bad spec targets. And before I sign off, we are doing a new feature. We are setting up a thing where you can essentially record a voicemail. You don't need any special software other than a microphone on your computer. If you go to quietspeculation.com/QSCast, you'll be able to find our podcast archive, and importantly, you'll be able to find our widget with the SpeakPipe program, which will allow you to record up to a minute and a half of a question or a comment you'd like for us. You'll find our guidelines and our requests on there, but basically any questions you have about Magic Finance or things in broader life, you can go ahead and ask us. We will play the voicemails that we choose to answer on the podcast, and we will devote time to them as we get good ones in. So you have about a minute and a half to record, and you can tell us what you think. So until next week, we hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great weekend, and join us again as we talk about Grand Prix Pittsburgh.
Until next week, I am Doug.
I am Kelly.
I'm Chaz.
And you have been listening to QS Cast.